Welcome back to Logical with Ludmila, where we untangle the legal knots so that you don't have to. I'm Ludmila Yamalova, a U.S. qualified lawyer based in Dubai. In each episode, we break down complex law into clear, practical insights that you can actually use. In today's episode, we are talking about the UAE's biggest change to civil law in the last 40 years. And it is called the new UAE Civil Transactions Law. In particular, it's the Federal Decree Law Number 25 of 2025, which came out in 2025, but in fact came into effect, i.e. became enforceable as of 1st of June of 2026, so just this year. And in general terms, it's a very large body of law. But at a high level, it replaces the previous, what was called the Civil Code, that was in existence since 1985. It is a big topic, and so we're going to take it in pieces. But just to kind of give you, a visual and of its importance, since I think about 2020, which is kind of right in the peak of COVID, when the UAE started transformatively reforming its UAE legislative platform or systems and started changing one law after another, after another, after another. And basically since 2020, it replaced, until about 2025, it replaced perhaps every law imaginable except this one. The UAE Civil Code, which was in existence since 1985, basically was the last remaining law in relative terms that had not been touched. And perhaps for good reasons, and we'll delve into it as we go through through the discussion. From a visual perspective, I mean, here it is. I've printed out the law, just, and it says double-sided, by the way. These days we don't really buy books. Everything is digital, and some things you need to be able to touch and feel, and I am of the generation where I still like my paper, and I still like to highlight things, so hence I printed it out, but I figured it's also fairly helpful to see what we're talking about. So it's a very, very large body of law, and perhaps this is also explains why it took so long for the UAE, so long, obviously, it's all in relative terms. The UAE moves very fast when it decides to make a change, and so transformation to its legislative platform is a perfect example and point. But this was one law that remained, or perhaps was the last one kind of to follow, and that's for obvious reasons, because it covers so much. Now, why does it matter? Why does this law matter in particular? Even if you have never read a statutory or statute in your life, well, this is because, in a way, it sort of covers everything. The way sort of life, civil and commercial life in the UAE takes place. So from the very high level, I mean, it covers, for example, the new age of majority and what it means for minors, so who can act for minors, what makes a contract valid, you know, how it is negotiated, you know, how it ends, what happens when someone breaks one and the contract, so what the penalties and remedies are. It also covers topics such as abuse of rights, you know, governing law and sort of unjust enrichment, various aspects of property ownership and sort of defects to property. So let's kind of get into it more specifically. So as I mentioned earlier, let's sort of break down in terms of why it is relevant and why it is perhaps relevant to basically everybody who lives, works, and does business in the UAE. The UAE, sort of, again, this is the name of the law, is the Civil Transactions Law. So, and it's the backbone of civil and commercial life in the UAE. It governs, as I mentioned earlier, things like contracts, property, obligations, liability, and it's liability in all these different aspects of civil society between both people and businesses. So in other words, it's the rule book that quietly governs almost every day and every deal that we make, be it buying a home or signing a lease, lending money, starting a business, or even giving gifts or receiving gifts. So kind of in more specific terms, like almost every agreement you enter sits on top of this law, right? So it could be your tenancy, it could be your employment agreement, it could be a sale, a loan, a service contract. Think of it as, in more visual terms, kind of like the operating systems that runs underneath everyday life. For obvious reasons, most people never read it, I don't necessarily encourage you that you do, and perhaps this is why we're doing this podcast. Hopefully you don't have to read it. This will be helpful in of itself. But it certainly kicks in the moment when something goes wrong. So, for example, when the contract falls apart, or a buyer backs out, or a building has hidden defects, or a partner walks away from the company. So whether you realize it or not, it's the fundamental, it's the foundation of everything that we do as a sort of member of society and as a business. For the last 40 years, since 1985, that was a UAE civil code that sort of was the previous version of this, but that for obvious reason, that the old version was written before the smartphones, before Dubai and the UAE looked anything like they do now. So as of 1st of June of 2026, that old law is no more, and now this is the new law. And it's not just a tweak to the previous law, it's a kind of a full upgrade. And all 1,400 plus rules have been replaced, top to bottom, in much more clear language, and built on for businesses today's businesses, and sort of been modernized in almost every other way. Philosophical level, the message for this law, the message from the country behind it all is that the UAE wants to deal, wants deals to be deals and sort of the way of doing a business and living in the UAE. It wants it to be predictable, it wants it to be fair, it wants to be easy to trust. So whether you're a family buying a home or a company signing a cross-border contract, you know where you stand, and that the courts will treat you consistently. There should be room for fewer surprises, fewer loopholes, and a lot more certainty. And this is kind of actually interesting. I've shown you the visual, the very large book of rules and text. But this, by the way, is just the foundation. It's the foundation. It's not the whole house in terms of laws that really matter and apply to different aspects of our lives. Picture this. It is as a general rule book that sits underneath everything else. But whenever a more specific law exists and that covers your situation, that specific law will prevail. The civil transactions law ultimately kind of steps in to fill the gaps and supply the basic principles everything else is built on. Just to give you a more specific example. So, for example, if you're doing business with another company, in addition to this rim, this is kind of the foundation. So then the commercial transactions law that governs, and that's the law, as I said, these are much newer laws. Commercial transactions law was amended in 2022, so that's law number 50. For example, if you're setting up or running a company, that's subject to the commercial companies law. That is the Federal Decree Number 32 of 2021. So remember, I give you this is a foundation. Although this foundation came last in terms of the current or the updated version of it. So on top of it is just all these other laws that sit. If you have another specific law that sits on top of this law is the employment law, right? So if you're talking about your employment rights, the sort of payment, termination, end of service benefits, and so forth, that's covered by a specific law, which is the UAE labor law number 33 of 2021. Then if you're talking about divorces, marriages, custody rights, that's covered in the UAE personal status law. There's you know, we've done separate podcasts on this topic. There's multiple laws that exist there. One is for Muslims. That's the federal law number 41 of 2024. And then there's the federal decree law number 41 of 2022 that applies to like civil and non-Muslim personal status matters. So again, those are specific laws. Wherever there are gaps, this law covers. Or, for example, if you're a company that cannot pay debts, that will be covered by the bankruptcy law. We've covered that as well. And that's the federal decree law number 51 of 2023. Then if you bought a faulty product as a shopper, that would be covered by the consumer protection law. Again, we've covered that. And that was the federal law number 15 of 2020. And with regards to property, each emirate has its own real estate laws or property laws. And in Dubai, there's a whole series of laws starting from Dubai Law Number 7 of 2006 related to registration of properties and interest. And Dubai Law Number 6 of 2019 that affects or relates to joint loan properties and so on and so forth. So these are just some examples of specific laws that sit on top of you know, this basic law. And as if you followed my sort of my list of the other laws and the specific dates when they were updated, you will note that, as I mentioned earlier, the law started changing in 2020, and basically all those other laws had been changed by now. And so this is the kind of, although this sits as a foundation of all these other laws, this law came last in terms of being updated. So when we talk about, and I'll walk you through specific examples of, you know, again, we cannot discuss a lot of the nuances of this law in this one podcast for the very reasons I've already mentioned. It's too much to cover, but I will try to delve into the more relevant aspects of it. And as we go through the process, maybe we'll dedicate other podcasts to more specific topics or topics that we'll touch upon today, but in more specific terms. One limitation of this law, as is the case with so many other topics we've covered already, is that it applies to the UAE so-called onshore jurisdiction. So it excludes, basically applies to the rest of the UAE, all of our seven emirates, except two specific legal zones, if you want to call them that, which is the DIFC, or Dubai International Financial Center, which has its own laws and its own courts, as well as the Abu Dhabi Global Markets, which basically is the equivalent of the DIFC in Abu Dhabi. So this law and all these other laws that I had sort of rattled out earlier, for the most part, they do not apply to those two jurisdictions. For the most part, there are some exceptions. But so when we're talking about this law today, remember that it does not really, at least directly, apply to ADGM and DIFC. So now, in terms of the timing, as I mentioned earlier, because so much of today's discussion and this law in particular relates to contracts, right? The definition of contracts, the interpretation of contracts, the termination of contracts, and so on and so forth. And so timing is important because the law, although it was introduced, and as the title suggests, in 2025, it came into effect, i.e., this is as of when it becomes actually valid and we can rely on it, is in June 2026. However, as we will all know, a lot of the contracts have been signed before this, before now. So what happens to those contracts? As a general rule, and this will, much of it also will depend on how the courts will interpret it, but as a general rule, contracts that were signed and entered before the law came into effect, i.e. June 1st of 2026, will be governed by the old law, and then any sort of contracts moving to the future will be governed as per this law. I guess this is a general rule. Now, the courts will be the ultimate arbiters of how, of a sort of interpreting specific contracts when disputes arise, and how much they will want to rely on the old law versus the new law. Now, as I say that, I also want to highlight one more thing, is that as I was going through the law and the specific provisions of this law, and I kept going back to the old law and comparing, The old language and the old law, and trying to understand, you know, how transformatively different or how transformative the new law is compared to the old law. And to be honest with you, a lot of the kind of the general, the basic, the fundamental principles are actually similar to the old law. So it's not like there's a huge discrepancy and a massive leap forward in terms of fundamental concepts and values in the two laws. It actually isn't so. In many ways, they're very similar. The foundational principles. It's just that, as I mentioned earlier, this law was more updated. It's easier to read. It's easier to kind of understand and relate. And certain concepts are a little more refined, a little better explained, and somewhat modernized. But substantively, it's not. You know, it's not tremendously different, which basically means with regards to interpretation of contracts and which law will apply when. So if there's disputes that come up before the courts, which they will obviously come up, that relate to laws or the contracts that were signed before this law versus after this law, in terms of what we can expect, how the courts will interpret those contracts or those how they will adjudicate those disputes, there won't be a significant difference because fundamentally the laws in sort of the most kind of basic principles carry the same sort of principles. So we should not be expecting a huge difference in how the courts will look at the contracts pre this law versus contracts, you know, after this law. It's more about perhaps, and this is keeping up with the times, this law is in a way kind of becoming more accessible to the general, the layman, to be able to sort of read and understand and follow. So now, I don't want to get into too many kind of nitty-gritty nuances, but in terms of, as I was going through through the law and trying to figure out which aspect of it do we delve in for purposes of today's podcast, I went through sort of so-called the table of content, which it's not really that obvious. And I was trying to pick out the most relevant aspects and provisions in the law that would be interesting and kind of relevant for today's podcast and that we're actually able to meaningfully address at a kind of a high level. So, yeah, if you want to think about it, you know, there's four different buckets in the law itself. There is, you know, or maybe like five different buckets, you know, one bucket is just talks about the kind of preliminary chapter that defines and addresses general provisions in the law. And then there is they're called like four different books. You know, book one of the law talks about obligations, you know, what's the definition of obligations. And then book two is the type of contracts. And there's so many different type of contracts that exist. And so I guess, you know, for layman's purposes, think of this law as the law that governs contracts in general, right? So definition of contracts, interpretation of contracts, termination of contracts, penalties and damages related to end of contracts and such. So, and obviously obligations relate to contracts and sometimes, you know, outside of contracts too. But so anyway, so one book is about obligations. The other book is about the type of contracts that exist. Third book is what's called the real rights, anything related to property. And this is quite interesting and fundamental because we're talking about property ownership, property rights and such. And then book four is about security rights, you know, mortgages and, you know, creditors and so on and so forth. I don't want to go through too many specific provisions because they won't be of much relevance, and each one of these would actually deservingly perhaps call for its own podcast, but for the purposes of today's discussion, I just want to give you kind of a rundown of some of the more specific specific provisions that come up much more often in the day-to-day life. So these are the different books, so to speak, and the different type of content. And, we'll also put out a blog on this. And for those who are more interested in specific provisions and perhaps the more detailed table of content, it will be in the blog. So it will be, you know, that will be perhaps for those who are more interested in being able to go to specific law, the blog would be a helpful resource. Now, for the purposes of today's discussion, so here is what I finally kind of extracted, and this is the general outline outline of what we will cover today. So one is the age of majority and some aspects related to minors, the definition of minors, and what minors can and cannot do. So that's part one. Part two, we'll talk about guardians, because that obviously relates to minors. In part three, we'll talk about contract validity and so definition of contract. Part four will be about fairness in negotiations, and that's sort of a new kind of a, there's some new angles or new aspects of as compared to the old law. Then we'll talk about the abuse of rights, which is an important principle as well. Then we'll talk about governing law and of contracts. And, you know, this is, let's face it, most disputes relate to when parties' relationship comes to an end for one reason or another, be it employment relationship, a lease, a property agreement, a partnership agreement, what have you, but it's basic end of contract. So we'll have a we'll delve into that more specifically, and then damages and penalties related to termination and end of contracts. Then we'll talk about a concept of unjust enrichment, which is sort of somewhat sits along contracts, and then real estate defects and property rights. Again, each one of these could be and perhaps should be a dedicated podcast. And as we go through the process, we'll continue to put out more podcasts, you know, about specific concepts. But for the time being, we'll just so just keep this in mind as I go through. Through the rest of the podcast, I can't physically, and to your, and also for your own sake, I cannot delve into too many details on each one of these provisions, because it'll just become a week-long monologue. Okay, so now let's start with the first one. So the first first topic is the age of majority. So that was perhaps the biggest change that when the law was announced, that sort of made the headlines, and that's the new age of majority. So as per this law, and this, by the way, this is the law that sets out the new age of majority. Now, from under the old law, the age of majority was 21. This law lowered it to age of 18. So it's pretty big difference. And that, for those who are interested, that's specifically set out in Article 84. And among other things, there's quite a bit that talks about the sort of age of majority, but among other things, it's a little more nuanced, but also the age is now measured in Gregorian years, not Hijri, as was the case in the old law. So what does it mean now to be of the age of majority? So at 18, now a person now has full legal capacity to exercise their civil rights in every way, shape, or form. That definition of what that means is covered in multiple articles. You have some of the more notable articles are Articles 84 and 146. You kind of read them together. And in plain terms, an 18-year-old can now sign a contract, grant power of attorney for somebody else to represent them, manage their own money, dispose of their own property, and all without a guardian. So they can also sue, file court cases, but they can equally so be sued in their own right. Again, before then, they had to wait. All that had to wait until the person would reach the age of 21. And so now in the eyes of the law, 18 is a full adulthood. This is an example, I guess, a perfect example of how the law has modernized, or why it's sort of this specific provision is a reflection of the law being modernized. And that's because, let's face it, these days, 21 is almost like you're going over the hill. 18 is you're kind of an immature adult, because kids mature so much earlier these days, and especially with social media and all the tools and avenues that opened up and exposed the younger generation to, from influencers who are basically kids who are influencers and making their own money and trying to make their own decisions. So and we have covered this in many podcasts over the last 7 years that I've been doing this podcast, this is where a lot of perhaps younger generation kind of felt like they had their hands tied, because especially the influencers, they were you know, they had their own channels, their own followers, their own audience, therefore their own income, and yet they couldn't do a lot of things without the Guardian. So they could do so much without sort of the Guardian's approval and handholding in real terms, but in practical terms, they needed the Guardian to do so many other things for them, like open bank accounts, sign agreements for them, and so on and so forth. So inevitably, that age of majority had to be adjusted to reflect the current generational status. And so here we are. So now it's the age of 18. Now, so what happens below 18? So we've still have, and kind of in line with the same topic that I just said, kids these days mature, kids, youngsters mature a lot sooner. And I'm sure as I'm talking about this, those who are listening thinking, well, I'm 15, I'm 16, I should not have to wait until 18 to make these kinds of decisions. You know, I'm sort of already, I can make my own decisions and I'm capable to make my own decisions and to even generate my own income or do things of my own or, you know, make my own basically sort of decision on behalf of my own interests. So the law, by the way, kind of also tackles that side of it. And that's so anybody below the age of majority are called minors, right? But the law separates or kind of categorizes minors into two different categories. And that's on the basis of what's called discernment or the ability to understand an act and its consequences. The dividing line is the age of 7, and that's sort of set out as specifically in Article 85. So a child under 7 has no discernment at all. In other words, the access simply, you know, they don't have the sufficient reason and understanding to make decisions for themselves. So anybody below the age of 7 is called basically a minor without sort of discernment. And therefore, any acts that are made by them are simply void. And the guardian acts entirely on their behalf. Let's say a child who is 6, you decides to gift something. Well, let's use an example. I mean, like something a my ring, for example, to a friend of you know theirs or to a neighbor. So that would be an example of where that's not something that a child can be held accountable to or held bound to. So that's an example of a child below the age of 7 just cannot have sufficient reason to be making these kinds of decisions, and therefore basically anything that's made by them is considered void. Now from age of 7 to 18, the child has what's called, so it's called discerning minor. So has some limited capacity to make decisions. And then for that group, it depends on the nature of the act, you know, how the law looks at basic commitments that child makes, or the child in that sort of age bracket between 7 and 18. So anything to do, for example, for a purely beneficial act, like accepting a gift with no strings attached, it's considered valid. So, for example, let's say a child of mine who is 13 years old accepts a gift from a neighbor. So because it's a beneficial act, so that particular accepting of a gift is considered valid. But a purely harmful act, like giving away a gift, or standing as a guarantor for something, that's void. So, for example, that same 13-year-old child says yes, yes, yes to a friend of his. Yes, I'll, you know, if you want to buy something, I'll back you up. I'll give you some of my money, or I'll throw something in to as a guarantee for your debt or for something like that. So, that's basically an act that's considered harmful to the child. So, therefore, anything like that will be held void altogether. Now, there are also acts that could be kind of in between. So anything in between, like, for example, buying or selling a property, it could be avoidable in the minor's favor. So, for example, a minor who is 15 decides to accept something, like accept a property in their name. So because it is, and they, you know, go through the process and sign some documents that affect. If it's in their favor, that particular act will be considered valid. If it is not in their favor, you know, as per the guardian, then it will be considered voidable. And then at the age of 15, there's kind of a next category. So it opens up a few more options for those. And that's, again, to address the sort of evolution of the younger generation. And being 15, you know, many at 15 consider themselves full-fledged adults. So the law does provide for additional rights for those who reach the age of 15. So they're called a discerning minor. And at this point, they can go, that kind of discerning minor now can go to court and ask for permission to manage their own property in whole or in part. So that's, there's a specific provision in the law, and that's covered under Article 149. In this case, let's say the minor who inherited a property from, let's say, the grandparents, and so now wants to be able to move into that property or to sell the property. So once that minor reaches the age of 15, before 15, it's all up to the guardian to decide how to manage that particular property. But now, once they reach the age of 15, they can go to the court and they can appeal to the court to allow them, for example, to move into that property or sell the property or lease the property or what have you. So now one practical point, and that's kind of going back to what I said before. So this law is the foundation to other laws. And I'm sure as I'm talking about this sort of age of majority, some may think, well, no. But we've known that so many other things that have had the age reduced already. So we've been able to do this, so we didn't have to wait for this law to come in to be able to already do things before we, at let's say the age of 18. And that's true. And that's because, for example, the age to set up a business and the age to open bank account, they are not in this law. So that they are addressed in different laws. And as we've said before, for example, the trading age was already lowered to 18 back in 2022. And we did cover that specific aspect in the law. And that was under the Commercial Transactions Law, which was the Federal Decree Number 50 of 2022, which we covered then. So it's true. So the age to set up a business was lowered in 2022, but it was still the age of majority remained 21 until this year, 2026. Similarly, bank accounts and the ability to open bank accounts, they're covered by a different law, and that's a subject that sort of sits under the central bank regulations and in each bank's own policy. Generally, the central bank's mandate, they've lowered the age to 18 before this law came in. In some cases, with the guardians co-signing. So with regards to opening a bank account, many 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds have been able to open up their own bank accounts before this civil transactions law was introduced. So now this civil code has basically closed the gap between all the different laws that have already lowered the age, not in all the aspects. So this has now basically, because it's a foundation, sort of closed the gap for everything else. So, until now, an 18-year-old could own a company, but still needed like a guardian to sign a contract or a power of attorney. So it was a perfect example why this was required to kind of close the gap. Because if you can open your own company, fine, but signing a document that requires the age of majority to be able to sign and to be bound to that document. So in a way, to do it correctly would have, even when you're opening up your company, still would have had to have your guardian sign those documents. So now with this law in effect now, which is as of June 2026, now all 18-year-olds have full capacity. So now basically the law has kind of caught up in all other fronts. Okay, now that's regarding majority, the age of majority, and also minors and the treatment of minors. Now, that's talking about the minors. So continuing on with the discussion of minors. Basically, what does it mean, and how do the minors make decisions, and who can actually act for them? So that brings the subject of guardianships and guardians. So who is the guardian under this law? So interestingly, and this kind of for me as well, it was a fairly interesting point because usually we talk about guardians and guardianship, the concept of guardianship under the various personal status laws. And as we discussed in previous episodes, that's, you know, there is personal status law that applies to Muslims and there is those applies to non-Muslims. And so in each of those laws, there is your guardianship is addressed in quite detail. Now, this law also talks about guardianship and guardians. And in a way, it may even seem like to an extent, it sort of conflicts with, you know, to some, it may feel like it conflicts with the other laws. So again, this is a foundation to cover the gap. But ultimately, when specific law, if there's a specific law that governs certain provision, that specific law will supersede. Now, I'll explain, you know, how that sort of discussion, why it relates to my next point. And that is that, interestingly, in this law, so who is the guardian? So under Article 150, the guardian of a minor's property follows the following order. So first it's the father, then the guardian that the father appoints. That's that's the next level of guardians. Then it's the paternal grandfather, and then finally the court or whoever the court appoints. So if you look at the definition of guardian in that regard, so for example, here's me. I'm obviously a mother, so does that mean I'm not the default guardian? If you look at that list, I'm not a default guardian. I'm not a guardian in that specific list at all, being the mother. But as I said, it's important we keep this definition sort of limited to wherever there's a gap, right? So there's a specific law if we're talking about custody and guardianship. In the context of personal status law, it's the personal status law that will apply. And so since, for example, for me, it will be the civil personal status law, so this definition of guardian would not apply to me by default. It would apply. The other definition would apply. But for the purposes of this discussion, so that's what the guardian means. So it starts with the father and ends, if necessary, with the court. Now in terms of, as per this law, so the definition the capacity of guardian, who can be appointed as a guardian, that's set out in Article 151, and that's the qualifications of a guardian. You must meet, for example, just broadly speaking, it has to be capable, trustworthy, and able to manage minor's interests. And so this, by the way, is important. So when we're talking about the guardian in the context of this law, it really talks more about the minor's commercial interests, right? Not sort of personal interests, not decisions for where they go to school, so what religion they follow, which doctor they go. So that's also all covered under the personal status law. It's more about commercial or financial interests of the minor. So, for example, the minor inherits a property or inherits money or trust from someone. So who can manage money and property and interests that belong to the minor. So it's not a function of making decisions for the minor, what to pay, what tuition to pay, or how much to pay for a tuition, or how much to pay for the books or the clothes. It's because that money obviously comes from the parents' money. This specific law talks about, is in the context of minors, it's about something that belongs to the minors, their own money, their own property. Now, so what can guardian do in the context of managing minors' interests and minors' property? So, for example, for day-to-day matters, the guardian acts directly. No court approval needed. And that covers things like, for example, short leases, collecting debts, paying what is owed, and maintaining the property, and spending on the minor's needs. So, more specifically, let's say the minor has inherited property from the grandparents. So now as a guardian, the father, let's say as per this law, the father would be the default guardian. So the father then can act on behalf of that minor to lease the property, to pay various debts related to the property, to just make decisions about maintaining the property, and also spending any kind of money related to, for example, the minor's interest. So let's say there's money also in the minor's account that the father needs to be able to reach to pay for the for school tuition or and such. So this is an example of where the guardian, in this case the father, would be able to act without having the court approval. Now, with regards to the bigger decisions, the guardian cannot act alone. So, and that relates to more sort of fundamental interests related to, again, minus property, such as selling the property or mortgaging the property, lending it, or entering into a settlement agreement. All of that now requires the court's approval. So the guardian cannot act on behalf of the minor. So, for example, the minor owns a property, and now the father or the family decides that, or even the minor decides that they want to sell the property. Now they cannot make that decision alone. That decision has to go to the court, and the court will have to approve it and supervise that sale of that property. And so in that, by the way, it happens quite often, and I think we've covered this in previous podcasts, is that, let's say the property is owned in the name of the minor. And by the way, in the UAE, minors can own property, so there's no specific age. But if that property is to be sold, it will require from A to Z, it will be done through the court. So the court will have to authorize the sale. The money will have to come into the court, and then the court will decide basically where the money will go. Will it go to the child's dedicated bank account or to the family, and so on and so forth? So it's all sort of handled through the courts. And obviously the logic is very simple. The bigger the risk to the minor's wealth, the more oversight the law requires. And it's especially in cases, for example, where the parents are separated, right? Where, let's say, the mother or the father may want to sell the property, and let's say the father wants to sell the property and the mother thinks it's not in the benefit of the child to sell the property. So these are obvious reasons for why the courts take that sort of burden on themselves to manage and protect the interests of the children. And then, as I mentioned, so this is kind of the one important cross-reference. The civil code gives the kind of the framework, but the detailed rules on appointing, supervising, and removing the guardians sit in personal status law, depending on whether you're civil or Muslim. It will be that law that will apply. So the guardianship is really governed by multiple sets of laws. But the practical point is, if you are dealing with the property that belongs to a minor, check who the guardian is and whether that deal needs the court sign off. Okay, so now we talked about the age of majority, we talked about minors and the guardians. Now let's move to the bigger subject, and that's that one of contracts. What makes a contract valid? Contract has so many different parts to it. So it's what makes a contract a contract to begin with? Who can sign contracts? How you terminate contracts? What types of contracts? And sort of what do you, how you end contracts, and what the penalties and damages for breaching contracts or terminating or ending contracts are. So again, very, very, very big subject. So just for the purposes of today's podcast, I will only kind of browse through it at a high level. So first, the starting point is the definition of a contract. What makes a contract a contract? So this is, without getting into two legalese, the contract, basically, for a contract to be valid, it has to have three elements. So one is mutual consent, and it's offer and acceptance. So I offer to sell you the property, let's say $1 million, and you accept it to buy it for $1 million. So that's basically called the mutual consent. The offer and the acceptance have to match. So I offered you $1 million, you accepted $1 million. If you accept, for example, 800, there's no contract. That's basically, there's no mutual consent, right? So there's no offer and acceptance. And that's because, so this mutual consent refers to what's called the meeting of the mind. So you and I have to be on the same page with regards to sort of material elements, i.e. I sell you for this price and you accept it for that price. The second element, it was called the subject of the contract. So the subject has to be the thing that's being contracted. For it has to exist, and it has to be capable of existing. It must be clearly defined. So what that means is, for example, you know, I can't sell you, let's say, a property that I don't own, because that does not exist, right? So that's a subject that does not exist. Nor can I sell you an interest in the piece of slice of the moon, because that's not capable of existing. So these are some examples of whatever the contract that we enter into, it has to relate to something that exists and is able to exist. Then the third is that it has to be, the contract has to be for a lawful cause, or so a lawful purpose behind the agreement. So we cannot, for example, enter into a contract to do something that's illegal, right? So let's say in the UAE, for example, to gamble or to sell weapons, for example. So in the UAE, it's considered illegal. So that kind of a contract has an unlawful purpose. So therefore, it will not be considered valid, or anything to do with illegal substances or drugs. Whoever might have signed a contract like that, maybe in certain countries it could be legal, but in the UAE, even if it's a well-drafted agreement, you would never, for gambling, for drugs, for weapons, you'd never be able to bring it to the UAE courts to enforce it, no matter how well it drafted, how many different fancy law firms would have signed off to it. So that's this in terms of the contracts. And by the way, another sort of, when we're talking about the subject matter of the contract being sort of it's supposed to exist, and it's also supposed to be defined. In other words, you cannot agree on the contract where the material terms are not well defined. Material terms are what? I mean, it depends obviously on the nature of the contract, but usually it's price, it's time, and I guess it's the subject, right? So give you an example. So let's say if you're saying, I will sell you a villa for 1 million dirhams. Well, that's not clearly defined, because what villa? Which villa, right? So that contract is not valid. Even if we have a price negotiated, so I say I will sell you for 1 million dirhams and you accept, but we don't specify which villa it is, that contract is not valid. Similarly, let's say if I offer to build something for you, and I'll build you an apartment, and I'll even describe the apartment, and I will name the price, but I don't tell you when I will deliver that property or that apartment. That also becomes an undefined, so indefinite contract, and that's not a valid term, because if we don't have a specifically defined term, then I can give it to you. I say, well, yes, I was going to build this for you in 100 years, right? So that's a term that's considered to be material term to our contract, and it's not defined. Therefore, we don't have an enforceable contract. Or for example, I'll tell you, so we talked about the time, we talked about the subject matter, or let's say price. So I will sell you my villa, you accept, but we don't talk about it. And I define the price, and I even tell you, I will sell you my villa, next month. So we have the specific villa, we have the specific time, but we don't have the price. So if we don't have the price, again, that contract is considered just not definitive enough, and therefore not enforceable. So in other words, to have a valid contract, you need to have these material elements, and without these material elements, we have no enforceable contract. So, and this is a subject that we can dedicate a specific or like a specific, a more in-depth podcast on, because it relates to so many different types of contracts, many of which often in this country are arguably, theoretically, would be considered as unenforceable because they're not definitive enough. But for the purposes of today's discussion, I guess we'll leave it at that. Now, in terms of, there's another element to validity of contract, that's capacity. Who can enter into a contract? So obviously, we discussed before, only those who are of the age of majority can enter or sign the contract. And then in terms of, there's certain, so anybody who is the age of majority, so by default considered to be capable to enter the contract. But sometimes if somebody is mentally impaired, for example, then there's the capacity, arguably capacity is impaired, and therefore their ability to enter the contract can also be questioned. Now, when we're talking about somebody's judgment impaired, in many cases, that, you know, it's not for just the family, for example, to decide, well, let's say my grandmother was too old, she wasn't in her capacity, in mental capacity, to sign off on this agreement. Usually you need to have either medical conclusion or the court's conclusion to deem somebody mentally or emotionally or in some other way sort of impaired, physically impaired, to make to bind somebody, and therefore to have a conclusive or enforceable contract. And in those cases, by the way, if a contract is entered by somebody who does not have the right capacity to enter, in that case, the contract is considered to be voidable. In other words, it's not a contract necessarily that was void from the beginning. It's voidable, and that's because someone later on, it turns out that someone who entered the contract actually was not able to, didn't have the sufficient mental capacity to enter. So therefore, that agreement is voidable. By the way, we've had cases like that as well in the firm, where certain sales agreements were signed by someone who, you know, basically the party, the purchaser who was entering the contract with did not actually have the legal capacity to sign the agreements, and then so therefore we had to kind of unwind those transactions. And so there's nothing necessarily illegal about it. That's why the contract is not void, but is voidable. Now, next topic is, and this is an interesting one, and again, we'll talk about it perhaps in a dedicated podcast. It's about the fairness in negotiations. The fairness in general existed in the old law as well. But the new law also introduces another sort of stage to fairness, and that's the not just the fairness in contracts, but the fairness in negotiating leading to contracts. So before you even sign a contract, so what's kind of the nature of the conversations and negotiations, and the party's overall kind of spirit. So the law requires for all negotiations to be fair. Because if they are not fairly handled, then you can be responsible for, and there will be liabilities that would result in damages that will sort of follow if the negotiations, for example, were held unfairly. And that's, you know, that's, again, this is something that's before the contract is even signed. That's an interesting concept, because let's say, if you entered in negotiations with a business, knowing that maybe that business had a potential other offer, and let's say it's your competitor, and you knew that there was a potential other competitor that was looking into buying or negotiating, and you knew that you didn't want that deal to take place, and you knew the timing was of the essence, so you entered in negotiations just to try to disrupt that deal without actually wanting to sign your own deal with this competitor. So your only intentions were to disrupt that deal and never really enter into your own deals. So that was not addressed. These kinds of types of dealings were not addressed in the previous code. This is a completely new concept. So now you could be held liable for those kinds of negotiations here. So in other words, you would be now liable for actual damage that this competitor, you know, this company that you would have entered negotiations with for the purposes of just you disrupting the other deal, you would be held liable for the losses that they would suffer as a result of your bad faith negotiations and, you know, the deal that they would have lost otherwise. So this is, you know, I think this is a very cool concept and is really interesting that is now clearly defined in the law, and I think it's much needed. So it's, you know, the idea is like you're acting in bad faith, and even if you don't necessarily sign on the dotted line at the end, but because you acted in bad faith, now the law will punish you for those kinds of actions. One important thing here, and again, this perhaps demands its own podcast, is damages. The damages have to relate to the specific example. The damages have to relate to a specific actual damages. So in that case, let's say that business, let's say, you know, you're business B and this is business A and this is business C. So let's say business A and C, they were trying to get into a deal to sell the business for $1 million. You were trying to offer $2 million, you know, now they didn't sell at all because you disrupted the deal. So you could be held responsible to pay the $1 million dirhams that they lost as a result of your nefarious and bad acts. So that's the new concept in the law. The other one, it kind of relates to the same, is the duty to disclose. And this relates to the same kind of negotiations on one hand. On the other hand, it relates to a lot of property matters in particular, but not just property, you know, partnerships or M&As or mergers and acquisitions, different type of partnership agreements. And it's all about the duty to disclose. So each side must share information that is material and decisive to the other decisions to contract. And here is the kind of the sharp part about it. You cannot contract out of it, right? So you cannot say, well, I'm not going to, you know, it's like we don't need to disclose all the material elements of, you know, of a deal. So those kind of clauses are unenforceable. So any clause trying to exclude it is, you know, it will be held void. And any deliberate non-disclosure can let the other side annul the contract. So a specific example, let's say you're selling your property and you know that that specific property has some kind of serious mold damage, right, or some kind of a water damage, and you just covered it up on purpose. Or, for example, you knew, and by the way, we've had cases like this, and this is, the law didn't quite exist in the same, I guess maybe it was not applied in the same way, or maybe the clients didn't want to take it forward. But let's say, this is a specific example, we had somebody bought a property and they, a condominium, and they did not know at the time, and nobody disclosed to them that you know, because of the position of the condominium or this apartment, it's set right over a garage. So when any time, the garage door opened, there was this just kind of rambling, trembling, shaking noise and it's a vibration that shook the entire apartment. Well, that's pretty material to the sale of property. And so let's say if the party did not disclose this will give you ground to completely cancel the contract and back out. And even if you've already taken possession of the property and the ownership of the property, now that whole sale can be undone or rescinded. For example, if you actually take it to the court and you can prove that this was never disclosed to you. So this, I think, is really, really important. And again, this will kind of warrants its own podcast in specific cases. But it also, let's say, M&A, mergers and acquisitions, and we see a lot of these businesses come together, they buy, you know, sort of merge, so to speak, but usually it's there's no mergers of equals, there's always acquisition. So let's say business buys out the other, and then in the process they find out that something was material was not disclosed. Again, in these kinds of cases, there is, you know, as per this law, there's a duty to disclose. If it's not disclosed, you can ultimately annul the contract, or depending on sort of the nature, you can sometimes argue this reduction of the price. Then another aspect of, again, contracts, and this is also always kind of one of my favorite, and it's the fairness in contracts. There's this kind of this concept that contracts need to be read fairly, right, and interpreted fairly. And that's specifically under Article 120, courts must read a contract to achieve what's called justice and good faith. And where terms are ambiguous, they need to read them in favor of the weaker party. So this is especially true in contract of adhesion, and these are the contracts of the sort of the take it or leave it contracts that you don't really have a standing to negotiate, such as your tenancy agreements, your insurance policy, so your telecom and bank terms, your car rental policies and such. So these are called contracts of adhesion, so the parties don't really have a chance to negotiate. So let's say that if there was ever a dispute, the courts would read that contract in favor of the kind of the adhering party or the non-drafting party, or in other words, the weaker party. And this protection is not new. It existed under the 1985 code as well, but the new law continues it and kind of emphasizes it further. So sort of at a high level, the ambiguity is read in the favor of the weaker party, and then you can unfair conditions can be modified or struck out by the court. And we can talk about this specific topic, and we have actually sort of a podcast kind of slotted to talk about this specific contracts of adhesion, such as rental contracts, car rental contracts, bank forms and such, because there's a lot of, or even sales and purchase agreements for real estate. You know, these are all called contracts of adhesion, then often parties find that, well, this is, you know, we didn't have an ability to negotiate, and yet it's so unfair. So anytime in these kinds of cases, any sort of unfairness, ambiguity, or discrepancy will always be interpreted under this principle of fairness. Contract has to be sort of read in fairness to the weaker party that didn't have the opportunity to negotiate. Next concept in the law is what's called abuse of right. And this has so many different applications kind of across different laws, but at a high level, this is a principle that runs through the whole code, right? And that's the idea that even any kind of legal right can be exercised unlawfully, right? So it's called abuse of right, and it's covered specifically under Article 106. And the basic idea is that having a right to something is not a license to use it however you please. So under this specific article, exercising a right is unlawful in four situations. One, if you exercise it only to harm someone else, or if the interest you're pursuing is disproportionate to the harm it causes to the other side, or if the purpose is contrary to the law or the public order or morals. And finally, if it exceeds what customs would consider as acceptable. So it's called abuse of right. And that applies, again, in so many different elements and so many different types of circumstances. By way of example, a person who takes an action purely to spite a neighbor, right, with no real benefit to themselves. And as I mentioned, example of, you know, getting into a partnership or in this trying to buy or making an offer to buy a competitor just to disrupt their other deal. So that's kind of abusing the right. Even if the right itself exists on paper, right? You have a right to sell something or to file a case. But like if you're abusing that right, then that's called an abuse of right. And so the new code refines that doctrine and sharpens the proportionality test, weighing the benefit you gain against the harm you cause. So it's a little bit of a sort of a more refined definition that exists in the previous law. So the takeaway is the right, you know, a right used as a weapon with no legitimate purpose will not be protected. Next concept is the governing law, and that's the choosing the law of the contract. If you sign a contract that crosses borders, and let's face it, in the UAE, that happens all the time because, you know, this is such a multi-jurisdictional and kind of a multinational society that there's always parties that are based in different parts of the world and signing contracts or dealing with one another sort of across jurisdictions. So what law applies if you sign a contract? So the new law gives a sort of slightly more clear answer than before, but again, fundamentally, there's many similarities that are being carried through from the previous, from the old law. So the headline is the parties have autonomy to basically to decide which law to apply to their contract. So that sort of right of autonomy is a little more strengthened from the previous law. And that's, you know, Article 19. The parties can choose the law that governs the contract, both its form and the substance. You have agreed a governing law, you now have a clear statutory basis for that choice. Now, if you didn't choose the law specifically, then the parties, then the code, this is where the code will fill in the gap. And generally speaking, it applies the law of the party's common domicile. So if they're domiciled in different countries, the law of the place where the contract's principal obligation is to be performed. So, for example, you sign a contract, this one party's in, let's say, Australia, and one is in the UAE, and they don't mention which law would apply to their contract, but majority of that contract were to be performed in the UAE, then by default, by virtue of this law, it would be the UAE law that will apply because majority of the contract sort of principal obligation is to be performed in the UAE. Now, the law also sets out it's a reminder, really. So there's limitations to how much you can choose the choice of law. Certain aspects of the law cannot be of matters cannot be contracted out. So, for example, foreign law cannot be applied and conflicts that conflicts Sharia or the UAE public order or morals. So, for example, you cannot sign a contract, as I said, and make it subject, you know, contract regarding gambling, you know, in the UAE, but make it subject to a different law. So if, you know, if the contract of the parties are based here, and even if it's subject to a different law elsewhere, you know, that's basically... it will be, for the most part, the contract here will be held invalid. And also certain matters stay with UAE law regardless of what parties put in. So, for example, rights over property, real property that relates to the UAE, they are subject to the UAE laws. You cannot, in the property dispute, you cannot contract for, let's say, you're selling property to me here in the UAE. You cannot make that law be, or that contract be subject to the U.S. laws, because we are talking about real property that is based in the UAE. Similar employment is subject to the UAE labor laws. If we're talking about employment in the UAE, it has to be subject here. We cannot make it subject to, let's say, law in China. So that's that. There's a limitation to that. And then there's another example is the commercial agencies as well. They're subject to the UAE laws. This is just some examples. So in other words, there is an autonomy. Parties have a choice which law they want to choose with limitations, right? It cannot be against public policy, and there's certain protected categories that are basically off limits. Now, with regards to how the contract ends, now we've talked about what makes the contract valid, you know, who can sign the contract, you know, how you negotiate the contract, sort of how it's interpreted ultimately. Now we're talking about, you know, how to end the contract. It's basically, you know, there's different ways of ending a contract. But generally speaking, the contract is considered to be binding. So you can't just simply walk away, say, I changed my mind, right? So if it ends, it has to end in one of the defined ways, either by agreement, by court, or by operation of law. So the cleanest route is mutual agreement. So we decide, you and I decide that we had a contract, now we decide it's no longer sensible for us to carry on. So we, by mutually, decide to exit, and we agree on the terms of the exit. So that's the easiest way to unwind the contract. And that's set out in a specific article, which is 233. Now, that's, you know, that's a bit of an idealistic scenario. So usually when parties enter the contract, and if they decide, you know, to terminate, in many cases there are disputes about it. So that's because it's one party is not performing their obligation. So it's called there's a breach of contract. So if one side breaches, the other can go to court, and after serving notice of the breach, and ask the court to, you know, to take one of two actions, either to order performance, right? So you can basically order me to perform under my contract, or to rescind the contract. In other words, to sort of terminate the contract with compensation where it's justified. And so in that case, it's important to give notice of the breach first before the court can act. The court, you know, by the way, the court always has discretion. The court will decide whether it wants to compel me to perform or to grant me more time, for example, to perform, or to refuse rescission if the breach is minor. So, for example, let's say, and this, by the way, happens, let's say in the real estate project, I want to terminate the contract. I don't want to take this property anymore because it's been delayed, but it was delayed by, let's say, a few months, right? And otherwise the property is ready, but it's delayed by a few months. In that case, the court can refuse the termination because of the sort of the breach is minor compared to sort of the remedy that I seek. So it's really up to the court. Or for example, let's say, if same kind of example, or let's say in a rental agreement. So I'm as a tenant and I don't have the money to pay. And so the landlord wants to evict me, and I tell the court, I need more money. I need more time to find more money to pay my rent. The court actually can make a decision and give me more time to find money to pay for rent. So that's an example, right? These are the different types of remedies that the court can choose. Again, either compel performance, grant more time, or refuse rescission, or basically order compensation. So that's the other way of ending the contract. Next is an automatic clause, and that is the parties can also agree in advance that the contract will automatically rescind on non-performance without a court judgment. Now, it's a little bit of an idealistic kind of scenario because in most cases, in practical terms, you know, if you have this sort of an automatic termination, in most cases, you know, one party needs to give something back to the other, and they're not so willing to do it. So these kinds of cases usually lead to the court, So it requires the court's involvement. So theoretically, that. You can have an automatic termination, but it's only effective if the parties ultimately agree to it and act accordingly. Otherwise, it may have to go to the court and ask the court to sort of its assistance to terminate the contract. And then the final way, and this is we've covered this in the previous podcast, and that's basically a termination of contract for on account of force majeure. But interestingly enough, there's another, and this perhaps would be an interesting separate podcast, is on account of hardship, not force majeure, but hardship. So the force majeure is covered in Article 236, and basically where performance becomes impossible through no one's fault. And then basically in that case, the obligation falls away. That's we've discussed that in previous podcasts. And then but there's another element, and that's discussed in Article 224, and that's sort of exceptional cases of unforeseen hardship that makes performance excessively onerous. The court can't scale the obligation back to a reasonable level. Let's say a rental agreement, right, that otherwise would sort of be valid, but because of significant change in circumstances, let's say a massive sort of change, like COVID-19, that was a perfect example. So businesses lost a lot of money. They were just not able to pay their obligations. So we dealt with a lot of these kind of contracts back then. They had 3 to 5 year contracts, and they could not handle it just because the situation was such. So it was not necessarily force majeure. It's just that they were not making significant money to be able, sufficient money to be able to pay off their rent, and the landlords were trying to hold businesses or tenants to those agreements. And in most cases, I guess it's just a huge generalization, but in many cases, the court said, well, it's too onerous for the other party to perform this contract, so we will let them terminate it. So that's basically another way. Now, that's on the termination of contracts. Next is the sort of damages and penalties for breach. That obviously the part that everybody wants to know. If the other side breaks the contract, you know, what can you actually recover? So the first thing is to understand is that the UAE law prefers, as a default, prefers when it's possible, performance over money. So under Article 331, the court's starting point is to make the breaching party actually perform whenever it's possible. Money comes in when performance is no longer the answer. So when it does, then Article 336 says that the breaching party must pay compensation if performance becomes impossible, delayed, or defective. So first it's you perform. If not, then compensate. And unless you can prove the failure from an external cause beyond their control, obviously there's also force majeure in substance. You have to prove that. And remember that the procedural gate is your compensation is generally not due until you have formally put them in default by notice. So you can't just go to court and say, I want to terminate. You do need to notify the other party of their breach and give them sort of, depending on the underlying contract, certain notice. Now, how does the court measure damages? This in itself will warrant a separate podcast, but at a high level, where the contract has no fixed amount, the law says the court will award an amount equal to the actual damages you suffered. So this is very important. So it's usually at a high level, when the courts assess damages in the UAE, they always look at the actual damages. So the burden is on the party that's claiming and claiming compensation that they need to prove what actual damage they suffered. So if a supplier, let's say, fails to deliver and you cover at a higher price, the court will award you the difference. So this specific example where you can show the actual damages you suffered as a result of the breach of the supplier. That's the actual damages. Now, often, especially in foreign contracts, there's this concept of what's called liquidated damages. And that's basically an amount of damages that you agree in advance, sort of compensation that you kind of fix compensation in advance. And that's dealt in Article 340 of the law. And the key message is that the agreeing figure is not untouchable. So whatever it is, it's not just because it's in the contract does not mean it's so. It's going to be sort of fixed. The court can, in most cases, actually does reduce if the debtor, for example, proves that that specific fixed compensation that was been agreed in advance, that it was excessive, or the party performed to the large extent. So, agreeing to pay that amount of damages would be disproportionate. So again, it goes back to the actual damages. The court preferred to see actual damages versus granting these sort of speculative fixed compensation. And then also this amount can also be reduced, for example, if the other party can show that there's some sort of contributory fault, right? So that both parties kind of defaulted to an extent. So that same amount is not warranted because they're both kind of at fault. Sometimes you can also claim more than the agreed figure if you prove, for example, that the other party acted with fraud or a gross fault. And by the way, you cannot contract around this. You can't say that this is it, this is the amount, and the court cannot change it. So this is kind of up to the court's discretion, and it's not really for the parties to decide. So the one comparison for those who knew kind of the old law, the court's powers to adjust an agreed penalty is not new. It exists under the old law, but what is new is kind of the structure. It now specifies specific grounds and expressly brings in kind of your own contributory fault as one of the reasons when it might reduce compensation. So it's in the court's discretion to decide, how it's going to use its powers to determine compensation. Okay, so now we've talked about termination, now we've talked about penalties, and now there's another concept, what's called this unjust enrichment. So sometimes, in many cases, it applies, sometimes it can apply to kind of contractual relationships, sometimes it's in deals that are kind of outside of a contract. But its general principle is that it does not get talked a lot about, but the idea is simple. No one should be enriched at another's expense without a legal reason. So this has always been in the civil code, in the old civil law, and it was well known. And so in Article 318 in the old law, kind of in the new code, carries the same principle forward. Generally speaking, if someone receives money or a benefit without a lawful cause, they must give it back. And so the elements are basically there has to be an enrichment of one party, a corresponding loss to the other, and no legal basis for that. So no contract, no gift, no judgment to justify it. So, for example, some of the classic examples, a payment made by mistake, or an advance paid for goods never received, or funds transferred to the wrong account. So these are just, they're not necessarily contractually done, but there's one party benefits, the other one loses, and there's no justifiable cause for sort of that exchange to happen. So that's called an unjust enrichment. And in these cases, the courts will always claw back that payment to the party that's at loss. A related rule is recovery of the payment when the payment is not due. If you pay something you did not owe, you can generally claim it back. So this is an important concept, and we can talk about it, in other sort of podcasts in the future, because it is very, very important. But again, this exists in the previous law, and it just still exists in the new law. It's slightly more refined. So the takeaway is, always keep your paper trail. So your contracts, invoices, receipts, because without those, there is a way to claim unjust enrichment. Okay, so that's on that. Now the next aspect of the law is the real estate defects. This is, again, warrants its own subject, but I do want to say that, this is kind of layered on with a lot of the real estate, specific real estate laws, but this is important because a lot of the real estate laws don't cover these aspects of the kind of fundamental real estate transactions. So this is where this law really comes into effect. And that's, for example, relating to real estate defects. So there is, two separate regimes. And which one applies depends on the type of defect and who's responsible. So there's what's called the hidden defects when you buy the property, and that's usually a seller's warranty, it's called. So every sale is presumed to be of a property free of defects. So on the article 493 and following, the seller is liable what's called latent defects. And these are one that is hidden, pre-existing, and not detectable by ordinary inspection. So in that case, the seller is liable even if they did not themselves know about that specific defect. And so the remedy for the non kind of the other party is to either return the property or to keep and claim a reduction in price. But the warranty does have limits. It does not cover defects that were disclosed or obvious or should have been discovered because they were so obvious in the ordinary case. And you generally have 1 year from delivery to bring that claim, unless the seller fraudulently concealed the defects, in which case they cannot hide behind the 1 year such limitation. So the lesson for the buyer in these cases is inspect thoroughly and document the condition. So because anything that's sort of hidden, you will be able to recover or to at least rescind the contract. So that's kind of latent defects or hidden defects. That's one. Then there's the second one is the big one that applies to real estate owners in the UAE, and that's structural defects. And so they're covered by a 10-year warranty. So for buildings, kind of fixed structures, the contractor and the supervising kind of engineering, companies are jointly and several so liable for 10 years for any kind of total or partial collapse or any defect that threatens building stability or safety. And this, by the way, this liability is strict and it's mandatory. You can't waive it and you cannot contract out of it. And the claim must be brought within 3 years after basically the damage or the collapse or the discovery of the defect. So if cracks threatening structural integrity appear in a tower, for example, or a few years after the handover, the contractor and an engineer will be held liable regardless of any waiver buried in the paperwork. And then there is another sort of concept in the same law in the same sort of chapter of the law. It talks about the collapse that harms others, and that's separately kind of under different articles, and particular article 270, whoever is in control of a building is liable for harm. It's collapses if it collapses, it causes harm to other people. So for example, management company, right, if it's in control of the building and it's under their supervision that something happened, they will be responsible. Say a balcony or facade that breaks loose and injures a passerby or damage a car below, for example. So that it will be whoever is in control of the building that will be responsible. So that's also in the law. Now, next is the property rights and sort of ownership of the property. And that's fundamental. So this is in this law. It's not really reflected, by the way, these concepts of the defects that I just mentioned and the property ownership and rights are not mentioned in the specific property rights, property laws in Dubai in particular and other Emirates. So they stem from this law. The ownership and possession. So ownership is the most complete right the law recognizes. So it's the right to use the property, to enjoy and dispose of a property however you deem fit. So it stems from this law. And it's pretty, absolute. Then also possession is also protected in its own right. That's possession of property, for example, and it's even the possessor who is not the owner can defend their possession. I guess the best example is a tenant that takes possession of the property. They don't own it, but that's not to say just because they don't own it, they have no right. So possession, that's called the possession of the property. It's also covered some of the fundamental rights of tenants, or let's say somebody rented a car these are some examples of possession. So those rights themselves are covered and protected by this law, even if they don't stem from ownership. Then there's some limited real rights beyond kind of outright ownership. The code recognizes what's called lesser rights over property, such as user fact, the right to use and enjoy someone else's property. This is a specific term called musataha, which is the right to build on land owned by another. And that happens a lot in let's say, commercial properties where warehouses are being built in Dubai, for example, and properties that are owned by somebody else. But businesses invest quite a bit of money building warehouses. So that right also stems from this law. Again, this is a very sort of in-depth subject, and it's quite broad in its scope and its importance. So To be covered in other podcasts, but for the purposes of today's podcast, I'm just kind of running through at least the source, you know, where is the source of authority comes from, and it does come from this book. So what is new is that the new code tightens some of these concepts that exist in the previous law, like, for example, Musataha, the right to construct on one's land, must now be registered with the competent authority to be valid. So in other words, if you were to build that warehouse, you need to register that right. And without registration, the right is kind of null and void. So this is really important because it's kind of a real change, and it pushes the right into kind of official register, which it should be because businesses spend so much money building these, so they need to have them protected. And then also the code also introduces a new claim, which is an action to stop new works, so letting a possessor seek to halt construction, for example, that threatens their possession. So again, very, very important subject for particularly in the real estate context, so we'll cover it separately. But the takeaway is if you hold or grant a right over property, registration is increasingly the dividing line between the right that holds and one that does not. Okay, so now in conclusion, let me summarize. The new civil transactions law has modernized the foundation of civil and commercial life in this country. As we've said, so the adulthood now arrives at 18, and the law sets out clearly who acts for those and who cannot act for themselves. Now, fairness in contracts now reaches into the negotiation stages before the contract is signed, even if valid right cannot be abused. And then you can choose the governing law as well of your contract within the limits of public policy. Then contracts end only through a defined routes set out in the law. And then there's the penalty clauses as starting point the court can adjust. So it's really up to the court. The discretion is with the court to decide what penalties in the terms of parties' separation from a contractual relationship. Then as well, there's unjust enrichment, which is a very, very important concept. The clause back, what was taken without a lawful cause. And in the context of real estate or real interest, the hidden defects are covered for a year, structural defects for a decade, and rights increasingly depend on registration of those rights with the relevant authorities. So there's, you know, one more area we did not cover today, and that the rules on limitation periods, the statute of limitation, how long you have to bring a claim. And this is an episode in its own, so we'll get into it in the future. So the moral of the story is the law, as I said, this big, thick book of law, it sort of sits underneath almost every agreement you make. So it is now in force, and the date of your contract decides which version applies to an extent, you know, with some sort of finer points to be determined by courts. But generally speaking, before you sign anything or before you try to get out of something, know which law governs and what actually requires. And when in doubt, obviously check with the right people. That's all for this episode of Logical with Ludmila. If you found this episode useful and you like what we do, you can always find more on our website. That's lylawyers.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And for the full experience, you can watch our video podcast on YouTube. Until next time, stay informed, stay safe, and keep things logical.